All right. Yeah, that's the way to start everything off. I'll tell you, that just courses right through me. It makes me jittery. I can't sit still, so I'm going to jump right into things, all right? All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and today's show is going to be, it's one I'm really looking forward to. At the back end of the show, we're going to be digging into the Ukraine. We'll be talking with Alan Goodman, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we'll be talking about the entire situation in the Ukraine. What's the real dynamics at work, and what does it mean for people everywhere? Opening the show up, however, you know, last week, well, let me review what happened last week. Last week, we ran the first part of an interview I did with Hubert Salper, who's a documentary filmmaker, director of documentary filmmaker, and his earlier film was Darwin's Nightmare, and it was nominated for an Academy Award. And when I was at Sundance this year, I got a chance to see Hubert's latest film, and it's an incredibly powerful film, one that just has been locked in my head since I've seen it. You know, it's a film that in the immediate aftermath of South Sudan's independence, Hubert Salper piloted a tiny homemade prop plane into remote areas of the new country of South Sudan. Now, he was mining for stories in the land trapped in the past, but the land that was trapped in the past, but's careening toward an apocalyptic future. And the result is Hubert came out of it with his film, We Come as Friends, which yields shocking and profound insights about the continuing impact of imperialism and colonialism in the region. So today, we're going to listen to part two of my interview with Hubert Salper, the filmmaker and director of We Come as Friends. Without any further ado, here it is, and I'll be back when it's done. Here's the thing I wanted to talk about a little bit, and it's going to lead into something else. You were just talking about the need to assimilate people. And when you think about what we've been talking about, forces coming in, these colonial and neo-colonial forces now, you know, which is a little bit different than colonial forces because they set up these puppets that you're talking about, yeah. You know, the elite in these various countries. Mm. And then it all seems like they do it to themselves. You know, it's their own people that are screwing them up, you know. And when you look at it, you had some really amazing images. And I'm going to talk about the way you did this a little bit later, but there were some images that you had in there where you didn't have to tell a verbal story. Mm. Where you put your camera, and as you said in the beginning of this interview, and you let people speak, and the things that were brought out there, and there's some I really want to talk about, the religion aspect of things, because that was so damn powerful. And there were a lot of manifestations of it. One of the things that really stood out to me, it was like, you've heard the saying, I think, of when the colonizers first came to Africa, they had the Bible and we had the land, and real fast, turned around, they had the land and we had the Bible.
The woman you're referring to is a South Sudanese person. Yeah. Her name is Celestine. She lives in Memphis, Tennessee. She had to run away from civil war 16 years ago or 17 years ago and ran with six children. Now they're growing up in Memphis, Tennessee, and she was, by the time when I shot the movie, We Come as Friends in South Sudan, she also had just come back to South Sudan. She kind of found me in a cafe. I was really, really tired, and she said, do you need, you know, a coffee, and do you need to talk, basically? And then she told me her story, and I was recording it, and then she said what you were just referring to.
The other aspect of this is, and again, this is another place where you put this in your film, and it concentrated some of that thing about they had the Bible and we had the land. Now they have the land and we have the Bible.
Yeah, she says the British came and they with the Bible in one hand and the gun in the other hand, and took all our resources.
Right, exactly. And then you have this scene, modern day.
Yeah.
You have this scene where this guy, this missionary, I imagine it is, who's sitting there in his family, and they live behind a long, high, cyclone-fenced enclosure, and the people are going, but this is where we used to go. This is where our goats eat. And the guy looked at them, and with the most arrogant and just enraging face, not anymore.
Right.
You know, and that was something I thought you really captured well.
Yeah. That's, of course, a psychological problem that Europeans and Americans have. It's the idea that you're entitled to all the richness we have, and we're entitled. It's a motion of entitlement. So you go to Africa, to go to a place you've never been in your life, and you feel like you're entitled to have a nice big house and on the nicest spot with a good view, with access to water, and that's it. Because why not? Because I'm the white guy, so why should I not have a... So that is our pathological view on things. It's I don't think we're necessarily entitled to take all this, to, you know, metaphorically, to suck the blood out of Africa. If you think of it, some of the scenes in We Come as Friends is this famous railroad that was made by the British to push into the center of the Sudan to overthrow the Mahdist regime by then, because once you had a train, you could bring soldiers on end and material. But of course, the railroad wasn't only built to bring the soldiers into the continent, but to bring out all of the resources. Mm-hmm. In that case, the British were taking out cotton from the Sudan and agricultural goods. And now, actually, this train is running for the Chinese. And it's actually, as you see it in the movie, which is not explained in the movie, but it's bringing oil out of the Sudan to Port Sudan and then on to China. So if you look at the map of Africa, Africa was colonized, of course, on the coasts, right? Mm-hmm. In the south and the east was the British and the Portuguese and the French in the west. And it was also colonized from Muslim countries in East Africa. And very slowly, only the colonizers would push into the center of Africa. And one of the things, which is like now 120 years or something back, was to push railroads into the center of Africa. Of course, the idea or the pretext was we will make a railroad from, let's say, the Indian Ocean to Lake Victoria, which is in the center of Africa, to bring the word of God, to bring all these beautiful goods we have, to bring civilization, to bring, you know, doctors, and to bring civilization and to bring light. That's mm-hmm. what they said. Mm-hmm. Which is, by the way, in many flags in Africa, you find a star in it. The star is always what represents the light into the darkness. Mm. You know, and these railroads, which were like needles into the continent, were actually not made to bring all these things. They were made to suck out all the resources, and that's as simple as that. It's really metaphorically, it's really like a needle that penetrates your arm and sucks your blood out.
Yeah.
So it's a metaphor, but there is the core of the problem. The core of the problem is, what is the narrative? What do you explain, right?
What is the narrative?
What is the narrative of? And the narrative is our narrative. It's the Western narrative. We are explaining history and not the Maasai's, you know. The Maasai's actually, by the way, when the first train was built into East Africa, it was referred to as the Lunatic Express. It was built by Indian workers from India, brought by the British because they were a specialized workforce. A lot of them died as they were building this railroad. And this train that was going into the East African beautiful landscape, the Serengeti, and this amazing landscape, was referred to as the serpent of the iron serpent or something, or the iron dragon or something really menacing and threatening for the locals, for the Maasai. Mm-hmm. I think it was called the serpent, or maybe the serpent of steel or something, the serpent of steel. Uh-huh. And it was something really scary for the people there, you know.
Yeah.
Those sort of steam machine that came in. The same in Europe, the same in America, right? In America, it happened like even longer before, you know. Actually, not so much before.
But the thing too, though, even when you're talking about this in the railroads and whatnot, and look, I know the Portuguese were big on this too. And when you look at what happened in Africa, and especially in the 70s, when China was a revolutionary country, it was a socialist country, and they started to actually changed the railroads the way they built, like the Tanzam Railway, which would, for the first time, give countries closer to the center of Africa a route to get to the seacoast, so they could actually bring their products out. But in all the colonial countries and all the colonial powers and neocolonial powers, all of it was, they took stuff. The railroads all ran east to west, you know, and west to east. They all ran that way. They didn't go and feed the people who were living throughout in all the other areas.
North and south. They were going to the ports.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker-director Hubert Sauper about his newest film, We Come As Friends. And We Come As Friends tells the story of South Sudan and how on the day it was founded, it not only became the newest country in the world, but also the target of imperialist gangsters from all over the world. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, though, is because continuing this thing about these images, and you have a couple of images, and you spoke to the one about the Chinese, and the Chinese today being a capitalist country, which everyone can see, in a certain sense, the bloodthirsty pillaging of the world. Yeah. And you have a tremendous image in there where these guys, these Chinese oil workers, I guess, are in this bunker that, and you just, and no comment, you just have them, they're playing pool, and they're drinking, and they're air conditioned, and you've brought your camera from outside in. Mm. And you see all the devastation of people living in outside, and then you see these guys, and it's a bulletproof bunker. Mm. And there's so much concentrated in that image. And I wanted to ask you about, again, the power of image in your work. because without saying anything, you continually bring people in.
Well, before you can create a movie like this, you kind of have to experience these contrasts in a very passionate way, you know. I'm here at the Sundance Film Festival, and I can represent the Sundance Film Festival also in a very passionate way, with all its contradictions, you know. Like, we're in a hotel now, and in front of the hotel there's this big flame like burning into the sky for, I don't know for what, you know, it's contributing to global warming or something, you know. It's you can see contradictions everywhere, you know. And of course in Central Africa contradictions are mm-hmm. so great and so amazing. And once you live it and kind of feel it, it's very easy to represent it mm-hmm. as a filmmaker, you know. And of course what you refer to is cinema art. It's montage, you know. It's like, what image do you cut after the other, you know? And sometimes it's very simple, you know. And sometimes it's like alchemy. It's like a cocktail that kind of blows your mind, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like we're like a good poem, you know. It's like one word, another word, another word, and suddenly it strikes your heart. Mm-hmm. It's just three words, right? And you don't know what it is. It is what it is. It's art, and the same with images, right? It's filmmaking, and it's a very long process, you know. It's a very, very long process. I spent like 2 years nothing but editing this film.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. 2 years editing.
But full on. I'm not doing any job next to it. I'm not seeing many people. I'm just working like a crazy man for 2 years, you know. And every edit you see and every image you see after the next is the outcome of hundreds of hours of images that could also have come just after that, whatever pool table, you know. So it's really a crazy process, you know.
Why do you think it has that power? Why do you think that the images that you've chosen, and it's interesting because you know, we're watching it and we can see and it impacts us the way you want it to impact it, actually. But it's very interesting because we're not aware of the fact that you had hundreds of images before and after, and you spent 2 years painstakingly working on this to create this. What do you look for that actually gives so much power to an image?
It's very hard to explain what it is. It is a complicated and enigmatic process making films, or like composing music also, or. Mm-hmm. Making a good radio show, same thing, right? It's like, what do you...
It's a little easier.
You know, you choose out of hundreds of filmmakers, who are you going to talk to? You create the right environment. You sit down. The energy you kind of send out to sit with me and talk to me is what you hear on the radio. It's like people cannot see you, but I can see you, and in my voice is your face, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And same thing as a filmmaker. You are a part of a reality, and you play with a lot of these energies, basically. You create, in a way, being in a room with somebody, whoever it is. It's a president of a country, or a street child, or in Africa, or a UN humanitarian worker. You create some kind of atmosphere. You create an atmosphere of trust, or of curiosity. A lot of times it's curiosity. You know, people were intrigued. Who were those guys with these little cameras and this little airplane? And we were intrigued in their environment. So a lot of what you see in the film is the reflection of astonishment and passionate kind of experience. You know, honestly, a lot of scenes in this film, especially more than other films, I was really shooting as a first-hand experience. So things that happen in front of the camera are things that I had never seen before. I would never have expected it would happen. Sometimes small things. This woman who sings the song My Land, you know, mm-hmm. you could play it in the radio if you want. Sometimes I wake up in the morning in this straw hut in the village, and I hear screaming people. They're screaming. I think that's something terrifying had happened. They were basically preparing a funeral for somebody who had been shot just that very night. And it becomes a scene, and I'm just filming the scene. And as I film it, I am with an open mouth behind the camera, and I go like, "What the hell is happening?" It's like, this is crazy, you know, like what I'm just seeing, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I still am conscious that I'm a filmmaker and I have to make sure it's on focus and the camera, at least it has battery and it's running, mm-hmm. at least. And sometimes you're shaky because you can feel it. It's like I was totally not prepared to film it. And I just, like, 5 minutes before, I was fast asleep, you know, in this very, you know, like 5 meters away, you know. So all these things, and I think they transcend. You can feel it as in the audience, you know. That's the magical thing, and I think you really can feel it. I think you can even feel when the camera shakes at a certain point that it kind of shakes your soul sometimes, you know. Mm. It's a crazy thing, you know.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker-director Hubert Sauper about his newest film, We Come As Friends. And We Come As Friends tells the story of South Sudan and how on the day it was founded, it not only became the newest country in the world, but also the target of imperialist gangsters from all over the world. You know, when you've taken us through this thing, like I was saying, you've taken us through this progression of images and contradictions and all these other things. And when you talked about that scene of the shooting and whatnot after somebody had been killed, I remember it was just like you're there. I mean, that's the point, is that you're sitting in this whole thing. You're just sitting in this whole this collage has actually ended up being this point where you're in the middle of this terrible, you know, predicament, this situation, and not just the immediate. It uses the immediate thing around the shooting, but then again, in a weird way, you kind of also step back because you, the audience, is actually able to step back a little bit, and you're able to say, wait a minute, tie it together with bigger things. Because very closely related to that is the stuff that you had referred to earlier about the do-good entrepreneurial. Yeah. We're here to help the African people get a better life, and it ends up being the people with the electric company, the people buying, you know, swindling the people out of the land, and Hillary Clinton. Mm. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, actually, the funny thing is that you know, different people have different shortcuts in their brains, you know. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, when we came to this very, very remote place near Capoeira, where people live in a very, very traditional way, and then USAID is opening a power plant and insisting that electricity is really what those, you know, barefoot people need, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought, honestly, they did not need electricity. What they needed is to have a quiet life, to be able to live in peace, not have trucks running up and down, not have somebody taking their land away, and so whatever, you know. But when the ambassador was insisting so many times, we are bringing light, you know, this metaphor, which is very colonial, by the way, and suddenly it struck me, and I was thinking, electricity, you know, you can make electric chairs. So you can kill people. And of course, nobody talks about electric chairs, you know. But of course, electric chairs are going to be eventually installed in these places, and people are going to be electrocuted with electricity. Otherwise, you couldn't have killed them. Anyway, you were talking about Hillary Clinton.
She had a classic statement in the film, right? The thing about that.
She said some amazing things, you know, which I found from TV. TV was running in this cafe, and I kind of knew it, the show was on, and Hillary Clinton was, well, actually it was a TV that ran in loops, and you know, so it's like I saw it, and then I kind of waited until it's coming back. What did she say? She said that we don't want new colonialism in Africa. Mm-hmm. Basically, without saying it, referring to the Chinese. She didn't say we want the Chinese out or something, you know. But I remember when this show was on, there was quite some press on the internet. That's how I actually also probably found it, that the Chinese were protesting against what she said, like they didn't want to be the colonialists, and you know.
Mm-hmm. But
she also said, sorry.
Go ahead.
But I think she also said, when people come to Africa, and I think people, she's referring to investors. Not people like you and I think the people she was referring to were people who come to invest. Mm-hmm. When people come to Africa, we want them to do well, but also we want them to do good. So that, it contains a craziness within itself.
And especially because she said you can make a lot of profit in Africa.
Yeah. Well, I think that someone else said that. Okay. But it's this other person who said that was probably referring to what he heard of Hillary Clinton. It's a series of, it's kind of a parrot effect, you know. Mm-hmm. Somebody says something which is close to mad, and then everyone repeats it, and suddenly it becomes accepted and fine to say, right?
The sentence I remember is the thing, because we were talking about it earlier this morning, the thing about her saying that she sees Africa as the breadbasket of the world, mm-hmm. and of course she hopes that Africans will benefit from this. And meanwhile, mm-hmm. if you have any connection with the world today, mm-hmm. you're thinking about the fact that so many millions of African children and African people mm-hmm. die of starvation every mm-hmm. year, that the famines that happen all the time, mm-hmm. and I had seen the famine in Ethiopia, and mm-hmm. saw people pecking at the ground, mm-hmm. and you know, their skin so stretched over the bones, they looked mm-hmm. like chickens, and they were pecking at the ground trying to get rice,
yeah.
you know, and you could see the kind of interplay there. Like then it was the Soviets and the U.S. and
yeah.
While there was famine
in the Sudan, mm-hmm. like a few years back, when there was this biggest operation, I think in history, a humanitarian operation called Lifeline Sudan, at the very moment when this happens, the Sudan itself exported food, exported sugar to Saudi Arabia
huh.
for currency, you know. And the Sudanese government needed the currency to buy Mercedes-Benz and airplanes and air-conditioned offices and go shopping in London, you know. That's a fact, you know.
Yeah.
And Ethiopia is quite an extreme example, too. In Ethiopia is exporting food. Ethiopia is now producing, I think, a lot of biofuel also. And also, at the same time, in Ethiopia, people are still very, very poor, you know, a lot of people. But also, a lot of people are very rich now mm-hmm. in Ethiopia. And there's something we shouldn't forget is that, like, what we refer to as this north-south, let's say, polarity of richness and poor people, it doesn't really match anymore. It's like this, the first world has its outposts everywhere in the world now. So in every poor country in the world, you can go to a Hilton hotel, check in, pay $300 a night, have a massage and sushi at night, you know, in the poorest countries of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So within this poor places, there are islands of extreme wealth, you know, and the other way around, you know. Within, let's say, what we refer to rich countries, I live in Paris, and like down in my street, people sleep on the street on Gare du Nord. Yeah, mm-hmm. people freeze to death in the winter when it's cold mm-hmm. in my neighborhood in Paris, you know,
mm-hmm.
And so on and so forth. So the third world, what is referred to as third world and the first world, is no longer necessarily a geographic notion, you know.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker-director Hubert Sauper about his newest film, We Come As Friends. And We Come As Friends tells the story of South Sudan and how on the day it was founded, it not only became the newest country in the world, but also the target of imperialist gangsters from all over the world.
There is yeah. a point to also the fact that, I mean, look, a lot of the things that exist, a lot of the you know, there's a connection between what goes on in the imperialist countries and those islands of extreme wealth
yeah.
in the oppressed countries, oppressed nations, because yeah. oftentimes what's that concentrated on is one, to enable the imperial countries to come in, the people yeah. from the imperialist countries to come in and set up their shop there, to yeah. base themselves in there, but it also
right.
serves a ruling class in that other
right.
that country
yeah.
that can then rule over the vast majority.
Yeah.
And the thing
yeah.
is that in both cases that you mentioned, yeah. whether it's France or the U.S. and the massive amounts of, yeah. of you know, the gigantic amounts of wealth concentrated yeah. in the hands of a few, and then the massive suffering of so many, same thing multiplied over and over again in these various so-called third world countries.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to bring up about, because it gets back to, again, is pathology yeah. or system, right? Because
yeah.
in Ethiopia, you know, one of the things that happened in Ethiopia during the famine was that Ethiopia once had the hardiest strain of wheat you could find anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. came in and they engaged in a lot of genetic engineering. And they said, we're going to make it even stronger. It'll be able to withstand all this stuff. So they did that. They screwed around with all the Ethiopian wheat. And then when they developed this strain of wheat, they took all the seeds and they put it in the seed bank in Rome. So the Ethiopians were left with two things.
To buy it.
Huh? But they couldn't buy it because they couldn't afford it.
Hmm.
You know, and so what happened was they were left there with no longer had any wheat. It was all dying off. Why? Because desertification tied in directly to the impoverization of the people
yeah.
due to imperialism. And so you had this whole, just this interlocking and down-pressing thing that was constantly in operation.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I got. And again, this comes back to this power of image, because as you presented all this,
mm.
you concentrated a lot of that history, but also the present day reality for people. You know, I mean, it was very heavy when you would go from the Europeans and the Americans and what they're living in and the Chinese, and then you would show the garbage pits that yeah. people were living in, or you would that one scene about this is where we bury our dead.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to live here, you know.
Yeah.
And but this is that dichotomy, that two opposing things.
Dialectic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to say one thing. It is in a way very easy to juxtaposition misery and wealth. You know, mm-hmm. it's actually very easy. You know, you take a camera, you film a trash can, mm-hmm. and then you film somebody on a very beautiful dining table. You cut it together, and it's a contrast, and it's people are scandalized about mm-hmm. it. You know, I was not pushing that button
mm-hmm.
The way I could have. You mm-hmm. know, because I filmed a lot of things. I filmed children eating rotten noodles out of a trash can, which was just behind the UN camp, with worms and it was so scary and it was so terrifying, but I did not put it in a movie because it would have kind of diverted the argument of the mm-hmm. movie. It's almost like porn, you know. What do you want to show? What do you want to do? You know, and it's like as on itself. Would have taken away the attention of the viewer, of the more subtle and more important, you know, narrative of my film. I didn't film it in hospitals or leprosis people, or I didn't film burned corpses, which I saw, of course, you know, because if you mm-hmm. spend so much time in a place of in war, you see very terrifying things. But I didn't film that. The only thing I did was I took some footage from a soldier because I thought it was very important mm-hmm. to kind of make a point that there is actually war. You know, it's not like just on the radio. And then I cut to a swimming pool, which is the very day when I shot that swimming pool. I mean, nobody knows that. It doesn't really matter, but it matters to me because I remember it was the very moment when the war. In this oil field called Higlik, it was I think the last days of March 2012, and that very day I was trying to find one of the ministers in South Sudan, and he wasn't. I couldn't find him because he was in some reunion, and actually the cabinet had agreed to start that war and to transgress that border to North Sudan. And many thousand people died, and eventually no one talked about it anymore because actually it was the army, the SPLA, had to pull back, and it was no one talked about it anymore. Suddenly, like 2 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that this at this very moment of the attack, this burning oil field, these dead bodies, and which were filmed live by our soldiers. This happened synchronized with the moment that I was in a swimming pool in the capital of Juba, filming, you know, investors having a cocktail, you know, and including myself. I mean, I was in the same, you know, swimming pool, and I actually jumped in that swimming pool, and I was like just one of them, you know. It's like I was not in the war zone, and nobody shot me, you know. So mm-hmm. I wouldn't talk to you, you know. But it's this is the crazy irony of these realities, you know. And I think it's in a documentary film you can represent them in a way that gives you kind of an electric shock as a viewer too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
I think
very good.
I think very happy. I'm happy that it works, you know.
Yeah. One last question.
Yeah. Nina Simone's song Wild as the Wind. Why'd you decide to use that in this film?
Well, why not, you know? I mean, why not? You
know, Simone, I just wanted to know what it
actually, you know, I read today in the New York Times they wrote about my film. And did you read that?
No.
It's funny that you asked this question because there's a very good article about We Come as Friends in the New York Times or yesterday, I think. And there's a line saying like, why did the filmmaker use this American jazz, you know, in the Sudan or something? That's kind of a misstep, you know.
Oh.
And it was funny. It made me laugh because the whole concept of this kind of documentary films is you kind of make an agreement with the audience. An agreement is what you see is real. How it is presented is very formulated. It's a form of documentary film, and it's very extreme. So a lot of things you see have to be, you have as an audience, you have to be very strongly engaged, and you have to be, you as an audience, you have to be very strongly engaged intellectually, and you have to be able to read a lot of things in a second and third and fourth degree, right? Mm-hmm. So why did I use Nina Simone? It wasn't Nina Simone singing, it was a friend of mine called Malia, who's a beautiful singer. Mm-hmm. She's from Mali, called Malia, and she's from Mali. she has the voice of an angel, and I knew her, and I was asking her to record two songs for me for the film. One is Wild is the Wind, and one is Tomorrow is My Turn, which is at the end of the film. By the way, I gave her a picture of the little boy at the beginning of the film, and I said, you're going to sing for this little boy in the studio, and she sang it for him, which gave her, I think, some extra energy to sing it.
That's the heart that's involved.
So, but the choice of why am I using jazz music there, I can't tell you. It's because I think it has to be.
I love it.
It cannot. I mean, it could not be. It's like how could it? It wouldn't be in my film if it weren't. Like, and yeah, that's it.
That's great. On that, we're done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think maybe in this country it has a lot of heavy significance and connected to black culture and so, but...
And to the whole thing, I mean, look, the whole question that we're talking about, the terrible oppression of a whole group of people rooted in a system, and this is, Nina Simone was actually, she actually concentrated a lot in terms of the opposition of this and telling the story of this, the use of imagery around it, and her voice was...
Yeah, I mean, I love Nina Simone, but I wasn't like... deciding to put Nina Simone in the film for that. Mm-hmm, I think it's maybe it's because of its energy.
I like your answer. How could I not do it? We've been talking with Hubert Sauper, and we've been talking about his new film, We Come As Friends. And Hubert, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Michael.
All right, welcome back. As I said at the close of that interview, that was that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we were talking with Hubert Sauper, who's the filmmaker director of a brand new film called We Come As Friends. And that interview took place at the Sundance Film Festival shortly after seeing the film. And I'll tell you, I was really knocked back in my seat around that film. It was really just a very powerful, very beautiful film. And it really just sets the wheels spinning in your head. And you're thinking about everything that you learn, everything that you saw, how deeply it impacts you. And if people remember Hubert's earlier film, Darwin's Nightmare, that was nominated for an Academy Award, it also did something very similar in terms of really digging into and exposing what imperialism means for people around the world. And that's something that we rarely get an opportunity to see in the way that Hubert presents him in his film. So again, the interview was a conversation that took place at the Sundance Film Festival between myself and Hubert Sauper, the director and filmmaker of We Come As Friends. And that film should be available relatively soon. I think it'll be out there, actually. It's just being touring the festivals now and getting a just rave, rave response. So really, really something to keep your eyes open for, okay? All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Alan Goodman, writer for Revolution Newspaper, to talk about what the hell is going on in the Ukraine. So stay tuned.
Here we are, like we're gonna get war again. Coming hard, come and get a gun, join the gang. With the bang bang in the same song we sang. Coming over and over again. Speaking up now, getting more like a game. And it feels real like we'll under fake the fame. And there's never more than one truth, but you can't always tell your better half.
Always tell your better half of the story. Goes well with the better side of your face you show on TV. Give me a good reason why I shouldn't start a revolution. What's in the Constitution? It's this illusion that we buy. You cut the wings and then you say fly. You say the hero is the one that die, but the true hero is the one that doesn't live a lie and understand that there's an end out of the cycle. Who's the master? Who's the disciple? You can do what you can, but will you do it again? So what's the plan? Looks like we're gonna get war again.
All right, all right. There you go. It's Balkan Beatbox with War Again. All right? I just love that song. It's an incredible piece. And I felt that that was actually very appropriate for our next conversation. You know, if you look at what's been, if you've been following the news and you've been looking at what's going on in Ukraine, actually, it's your head's got to be spinning. It's just an incredibly tense and troubling situation. And Revolution newspaper recently wrote, "People are being lied to on a massive scale about what's going on in Ukraine." Yes, that's right. The masters of deception are lying once again. Okay, they're actually out there spinning their web. People are being trained to think uncritically and to identify with the interests and the rulers of the United States. And it's a very dangerous situation because there's a hair trigger confrontation between imperialist powers concentrated in Ukraine, but in other parts of the world as well. We really have to get people to stop thinking like Americans and start thinking about humanity, starting from humanity as a whole and looking for the truth, bringing it out. All right. And joining us to talk about all this is a writer for Revolution Newspaper. And I'll get my speaking voice down as we go along. OK, Alan Goodman. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's always great to be here.
Great, man. Well, let's jump into this because we're going to stuff a lot into 20 minutes or so. So, you know, as I was saying, the Ukraine, it's been just like amazing how quickly seemingly out of nowhere it just jumped out. It developed. Now it's got the attention of the world on there, you know, and there's all kinds of, you know, just back and forth and all kinds of web spinning and all this about the dynamics involved in the situation with all the imperialist powers involved, each side claiming to be taking the high road and being morally correct and so on. So let's kick this around. To start this off, what are the actual overall dynamics in motion here?
Well, I actually think it might be worth pulling back to what are we being told are the actual dynamics and then contrasting them to the real dynamics.
Okay.
We are just being bombarded, and, you know, I'm following this closely, reading the statements from Obama and Kerry and all the different officials of the U.S., of all political stripes, and they're all formulating it as there's two things going on here. One is the United States cannot stand by and watch while the territorial integrity of another nation is abused or disrespected or trampled on. And the other is that the United States is motivated by and driven by the aspirations of the people of the Ukraine. And so step one is, and, you know, we need to really expose the hypocrisy behind this, and we've been doing that. You know, those two things have nothing to do with what the United States is doing in Ukraine. And in fact, you know, as we've been posing at revcom.us, if you're looking for a country that's trampled on the territorial integrity of other nations, look no further than the United States, which has an unparalleled record for this, and we need to dig that record up. And then I think we can get into, you know, well, okay, what is actually driving this, and what is driving it just is the maintenance and enforcement of the world of horrors that your previous guest, Herbert Sauper, right, was talking about. Hubert Sauper was talking about, you know, the system that grinds up people's lives and crushes their spirits literally all around the world. And that is essentially what is being enforced when the U.S. and, from its side, Russia, and then the various other reactionary forces involved are fighting over who is going to have the upper hand in Ukraine.
You know, one of the things it might be worthwhile even just talking a little bit about this hypocrisy question, because, you know, it's very heavy. I was, when I looked at what was in Revolution newspaper and just the listing of all the various times that the U.S. has intervened and just stomped all over other countries, other peoples, this is an incredibly, I mean, it really strikes you deep. To get a sense of how deep that is, you know, how frequent that was and how devastating it was to whole peoples.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if I can just share the experience, this is what it's like when you write for Revolution or RevCom. You know, you go look up these things and they're always worse than you realized. You know, starting from the glorious beginnings of the U.S. empire, the genocide of the Native Americans and the enslavement of African people. And then you've got, you know, the war against Spain. By the way, every one of these things has been justified with an utter lie. The United States didn't say we're going to war against Spain because we're an emerging imperialist nation and we need an empire to contend with other empires, to generate super profits on which we can build up a powerful military and contend around the world. No, they didn't tell people that. the radicals tried to tell people that. But, you know, there was always, remember the Maine. You know, the Tonkin, the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Someone else always attacked us first or abused us first, real, imagined, or distorted. And those were never the real reasons behind these things. So, you know, you're referring to an article that we ran, and it's all this is available at revcom.us. By the way, I really encourage your listeners to tweet some of these articles around, because we've got to break through some of the, you know, BS going on. But, yeah, the article is called The U.S. Empire Was Built on That, Trampling on Other Nations. And, I, you know, look up any of these incidents. What the United States did in the Philippines, they killed 600,000 Filipinos to establish U.S. colonial domination of the Philippines. They killed millions of people in Indochina and carried out, you know, terrible war crimes. And, you know, it really does connect with what your previous guest was talking about. I mean, if yes, you out there listening to me on the radio right now, look at the label inside your clothes. You know, look at where those bananas you're eating came from. Or everything else about our lives in America is built on an empire that was established through the most horrific, you know, to say trampling on the integrity of other people is really putting it mildly. Mm-hmm. And that's the compulsion to continue that empire. That's why the rulers of the United States, let's not identify with them. The rulers of the United States cannot sit by from their perspective and see a country that is a natural gas transit point from Russia to Western Europe. I think 30% of Germany's gas comes from Russia through Ukraine into Germany, and a substantially developed industrial and agricultural economy in Ukraine, and cannot just sit by and let their rivals, you know, move in and get an upper hand in all or part of that country.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's dig into this a little bit more, because, you know, the way it comes out still, I mean, okay, they talk about territorial protecting the sovereignty of the Ukraine, and that's that you've been speaking to, and you've been pointing out the hypocrisy involved in all that. There's also arguments that have been broached around oligarchs versus Democrats, and that there's us, you know, that we're just, that the U.S. is just coming in and they're just trying to, you know, this is the dynamic that's in operation there. And of course, everyone wants to side with the Democrats, or they say that the, you know, that there's also, well, there's other arguments we can get into as well, because I wanted to dig into a little bit this question of natural gas and oil, because there is a certain argument being advanced there, not just by the imperialists, but also by people in general in terms of explaining what's going on. So let's talk about both of those a little bit. What about this oligarchs versus Democrats?
Well, I'm tempted to say, what's the difference between an oligarch and a Democrat?
Okay.
It's a riddle. The answer is, whoever the line with the interests of U.S. imperialism is a Democrat. Never mind, you know, that they may be an ultra-nationalist with, you know, close ties to basically, you know, movements and forces in the Ukraine ruling class that allied with the Nazis and continue to promote a lot of that stuff. And, you know, just, I mean, my emphasis will be on, you know, the role and exposing the role and nature of U.S. imperialism here. Mm-hmm. But Russia's got its own motives. You know, the forces it's backing are no better. But, the, you know, the essence of it is there are contradictions in the Ukraine ruling class. Ukraine is a capitalist country. It's a country of 45 million people. Like I said, it, you know, has it developed agriculture and industry. The people who rule it, you know, again, they're capitalists now in different forms and with different styles and so on, but the essence of it is they're capitalists. I mean, we can go into that more if you want to. The oil thing is a big deal. I think it's widely misunderstood. I don't know if you wanted to...
Yeah, go there.
You
know, go ahead.
You raised a number of different questions, so, mm-hmm. you know, maybe we could break those down. Did you...
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Was that satisfactory on the oligarchs versus Democrats?
Yes, it was.
Well,
especially the riddle.
You know, and also, you know, and who are forces for democracy? And when it comes to respecting the interests of the people of Ukraine, well, there's about as many people, roughly speaking, you know, with Russian flags in eastern Ukraine guarding a statue of Lenin. And I do have to clarify, that statue does not today represent what Lenin really represented, and the people guarding it, I don't know who they are or what their motivation is, but, you know, you can, I use the example when I was talking to you the other day. You know, 40,000 Ku Klux Klansmen marched down Pennsylvania Avenue in 1925. What did that prove? Were they the forces of democracy? Was, you know, should that have been the basis on which people looked at, you know, what represented the interests of people in the United States or the world, much less the world? Anyway, you can't judge a situation by whether or not any particular political agenda has thousands or tens of thousands or even tens of millions of people in the streets. We learned that bitter lesson again in Egypt when 30 million people were wrong when they went into the streets, essentially orchestrated or at least under the wing of the political agenda of the U.S. and, you know, the military in Egypt to demand the fall of the Morsi government. But so that, you know, the oligarch Democrat, you have to get beneath the surface, as you used to say, and understand what real interests and agendas are at work here. And maybe that does lead us up to oil.
Well, let's jump into oil. And we'll have to time ourselves on this because we have about maybe 10 minutes left, so a little bit less. So why don't we jump into oil? And then I have one other big question. So let's measure it out that way, all right?
Okay. I mean, you and I were talking. I was interviewed on another show recently, and the host was making an argument that what is driving the really dangerous conflict between the U.S. and Russia, you know, in Ukraine, what's driving that is oil company profits, and that the oil companies are justifying fracking, which is, a lot of your listeners are probably familiar and understand this, but it's, you know, a terribly, terribly environmentally destructive process of squeezing yet more, oil out of poor Mother Earth, who, you know, capitalism has already, you know, devastated so badly, and building this, you know, dangerous Keystone, environmentally disastrous Keystone pipeline from Canada, and all this rhetoric about energy sufficiency for the United States. Well, yes, the oil companies will make obscene profits all off of all this, and that is part of the picture, but that's not what's driving things. Imperialism, you know, going back to the world that we were talking about in the beginning and that Hubert Sauber was describing some of its effects, that system relies on control of oil. Modern militaries run on oil. I don't have the statistic in front of me, but the United States has military bases in well over 100 countries on this planet. And they all run on oil, and so do the militaries of every other country, and so do the economies in every country in this oil-addicted capitalist imperialist world. And so control of oil it's not mainly or just a source of obscene super profits for the oil companies, although, again, that's a critical part of the economy of world imperialism. But even more fundamentally, it's geostrategic. It's why the Middle East has been the center for so much conflict, because it's been the main source of oil for Europe. And so, you know, that's what's going on with the oil thing. Did you want to pursue that, or
people should.
Question.
Yeah, I have another question. I'm sure people can keep going to revcom.us, and a lot of this will be eventually be explored in different ways on that site. It's really a very worthwhile site to go to understand all this. And that brings me up to this question, which is, you know, we've talked about, and it talks about it in Revolution, and you've mentioned it a couple times, that this is. What's happening in the Ukraine is not only happening with an impact on the immediate thing that's going on in the immediate world, but actually has the potential for presenting a great danger to the world. And I wanted to talk about what that great danger is, but then also talk about this other point, which is that we're not just being lied to, but we're also being trained in how to look at the world today in terms of what the press is doing, what the U.S. imperialists are saying, and the link between that and this great danger.
Well, one dimension of imperialism, you know, along with the vicious super exploitation of people in the third world and all the horrors that brings, is sharp contention between different imperialist blocs and powers. And, you know, without going into what blocs those are, there are forces that are, you know, from the perspective of the U.S. as, you know, the godfather of world imperialism today, there are forces that are stepping on its turf, emerging regional powers. But, you know, I think what you were pointing to is the key thing is how are people being trained to think and how should people be thinking? And I was thinking back to, you know, the experience of many people in my generation who, I remember I went to my first teach-in on the Vietnam War, and I thought the war was right because we, you know, look, if we're trying to protect democracy, isn't that a good thing? And then I went to the teach-in and I found out who these, so, you know, these forces of democracy that, quote unquote, we were supporting, and I stopped, you know, eventually I changed my mind, not just about the Vietnam War, but about, you know, I came to see a whole system of imperialism, and also connections were forged in that era between, you know, the black liberation struggle, the women's liberation movement, the struggles around the world against imperialism, and a revolutionary movement emerged that did see imperialism as a global system. And you know, you had a, even more broadly in society, you had the phenomenon of people identifying with the struggle of people around the world against imperialism. Now, we don't have the same kind of positive forces in the world today. You know, we don't have socialist China like we had back then. That was an inspiration and a bedrock. We don't have the Vietnamese people's struggle, which was an inspiring and a real liberation struggle. But that doesn't mean that, you know, those same basic lessons don't apply, and that we do have, you know, we have to both cut through this obscene hypocrisy about we're supporting democracy around the world and we can't stand by and let the territorial integrity of some other nation be disrupted. But we also need to bring forward an understanding that this all comes from a system, and there's another dimension to imperialism, which is that imperialism is the era of revolution, and an era when, you know, the world revolution is more than ever in history, an integral process. So, you know, this is all, I think, what our responsibility is to bring forward. And again, you know, you mentioned it, you'll find resources both to learn about this and to share online at RevCom. For example, if I can just plug one, because you'll find, if you go straight to RevCom.us, you'll find a link right to this stuff. But you know, we've got some, I guess you could call them polemics up there, like from the genocide of the Native Americans to drone strikes in Yemen. The rulers of the United States are the last people on earth to talk about respecting the territorial integrity of others. And stop thinking like Americans, stop thinking about humanity. So these are things that we need to really be getting out there. I don't know if that answered what you were.
Yeah, it does. It does. Although in a couple minutes, I'd like to actually talk about this a little bit more for a couple minutes. You know, this idea that the danger that's posed by the situation today, and what is the danger? There's actually a danger not only in the dynamics of the situation itself, but also in this thing of people not breaking through and cutting through all the lies and all the distortion that's out there. And this term, in terms of how they're being trained to look at the world today, and it does mean something in terms of what could possibly not just what's in the, you know, going on today, although that's extremely important, but also what could possibly develop in the future.
Well, these are things to study and understand better, but I guess I would argue against, for example, during the Cold War, there were people saying, you know, well, I mean, that's not a good example. But the point is, and I think whether or not this situation in the Ukraine escalates and, you know, evolves from economic contention to a military, you know, a more widespread, high-level military confrontation that even draws in other powers, or whether or not it simmers the way it is. In either case, you know, on both sides, and in any eventuality in between, on both sides, this is about perpetuating a world of horrors. And we need to really continue to bring that out to people. What are the real stakes? And then, you know, then people will be prepared if the situation does take a drastic turn, but they'll also be prepared if it doesn't. And, you know, again, ultimately, this is about the clash in the Ukraine between reactionary powers is about maintaining and enforcing and fighting over who's going to control a world of horrors. And our perspective can't be, how do we kind of, you know, support the lesser of evil or hope it doesn't, you know, get out of control or something like that, but how do we get rid of this whole system?
Exactly.
And again, you will find answers to that and ways to go about that at revcom.us.
All right, Alan, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me. Take care.
Take care, man. Bye now.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Alan Goodman, writer for Revolution Newspaper, about what the hell is going on in the Ukraine and why it's so important for us to understand the truth about this situation. All right, and that brings us to just about the end of the show, and I want to bring people something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, something that is really important in terms of keeping this whole what's going on in the Ukraine, being able to actually have a correct understanding of what's happening there. And believe me, having a correct understanding in a situation like this, which is both really, really both very important and very critical in its own right, but also holds the potential of tremendous danger for the whole world, all right? So it's important for all of us in terms of understanding what role we should be playing in relation to this, that you dig into this quote. And it's from a work that Avakian did called Bringing Forward Another Way. All right, it's a very important work, and it deals with a lot of what's going on in the Middle East, and it's worth checking out. Again, that's called Bringing Forward Another Way. Here's the quote from Bob Avakian. The interests, objectives, and grand designs of the imperialists are not our interests. They are not in the interests of the great majority of the people in the U.S., nor of the overwhelming majority of people in the world as a whole. And the difficulties the imperialists have gotten themselves into in pursuit of these interests must be seen and responded to not from the point of view of the imperialists and their interests, but from the point of view of the great majority of humanity and the basic and urgent need of humanity for a different and better world for another way. That's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from his work, Bringing Forward Another Way. And believe me, in times like this, it's extremely important that the people understand what is in the interest of the people of the world and what isn't, all right? All right, I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson. I also want to thank my assistant producer who helped with the interview with Hubert Salper, Annie Day. And I want to thank my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out now with one of my favorite songs of all time, just because it's such a damn good song, the Douglas Street Shuffle. Talk to you again next week. So, Teddy, let it rip, man.